The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 24th of June 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio 2 here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's programme, we chart the progress of Ukraine and Moldova's European Union accession bids as they are granted EU candidate status. Turmoil in the Tory party continues as Boris Johnson's ruling Conservatives lose seats in this week's by-elections. We will also discuss the worrying developments in Myanmar as the country's deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi is moved to prison. And as it's Friday, Andrew Muller will recap what we learned this week.
We learned anyway that it had been quite the week for banning stuff, as we learned that listeners to Ukrainian radio stations would henceforth have to struggle along without hearing much of this sort of thing.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. Ukraine and Moldova have both been granted EU candidate status. Leaders of the EU countries approved the move at a special summit in Brussels last night. Ukraine applied just days after the Russian invasion in February, and the process moved at a record speed. The path to membership is still likely to take a number of years. For more on this, I'm joined by Suzanne Lynch, author of Politico's Brussels Playbook. Welcome to the programme. Suzanne, was this expected?
Well, it was. I mean, the EU leaders had given a strong indication that they were going to support this bid for candidate status by Ukraine. The European Commission last week kind of brought out its official opinion, which stated that they did recommend candidate status for Ukraine with certain conditions. And really, the way these things work is that the Commission would have got a signal really from particularly the big countries, France and Germany, etc., that they were willing to support this. So really, in one sense, it was kind of a sign off by the EU leaders when they met, and they're still meeting here in Brussels last night. But they did all unanimously, all 27 EU leaders agreed to grant Ukraine, along with Moldova, candidate status.
How big news is this for these countries?
I mean, it's hugely symbolic. It's very much another slap in the face for Vladimir Putin. You know, we're now 4 months since he launched the invasion of Ukraine, and we're now in a situation that Ukraine is now actually moving closer to EU membership than it ever was before. So this is another inadvertent, unexpected, unintended consequence of the Russian invasion, just as we're now in a position where Finland and Sweden are about to join NATO. So from that point of view, it's a hugely symbolic moment. Obviously, in many ways, this current conflict had its roots back in 2013 and 2014, when we had the Maidan protests after the pro-Russian government in Ukraine pulled out at the last minute of signing an agreement with the EU. And that sparked the protests, which in turn led to the Russian annexation of Crimea. So a lot of people here in Brussels, including the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, really see this war as in part a kind of punishment for Ukraine for actually its pro-EU credentials, for trying to want to get closer to the EU. So look, it's very important. Zelensky welcomed it. However, as you said at the outset, you know, the issue here is that it is not going to happen anytime soon. The accession process for any European country to join the EU takes a long time, and this is not going to be any different for Ukraine.
How do you think this is perceived by, say, the countries of the Western Balkans that are now, I think, in their 20th year in the queue?
Yeah. So this is one of the issues. Before the summit began yesterday afternoon, we had a kind of a mini summit between the leaders of the six Western Balkan countries and EU leaders. It went on for about 4 hours and really didn't come to any conclusion. A lot of those countries feel quite disillusioned that they've been on this accession path for some time. One of the issues is they're kind of lumped together, six countries, whereas in fact, they're all very different countries. So there's now kind of debate about if that's the best way to approach it. But also you've got specific issues there with those countries, and you've got issues deriving from a Yugoslav war there that complicate, say, for example, Serbia's accession, Kosovo. You've got an issue around North Macedonia that Bulgaria, a member of the EU, is actually vetoing North Macedonia's, you know, the next stage for North Macedonia, even though actually as we speak, there should be a vote in the Bulgarian parliament about this. So that's one thing. So Ukraine is different. You know, it doesn't have those kind of issues, but it's got other problems. For example, Ukraine is a huge country and it's a very poor country. So that would have huge implications if it was to join the EU. It would have implications, for example, for the common agricultural policy. You know, Ukraine has got this vast farmlands. So, you know, that would cost the EU budget a lot. So those kind of issues now, the money involved, etc., are going to be the kind of things that officials in the Commission are going to start thinking about for Ukraine.
As we have mentioned already, the path to membership for both of these countries, Ukraine and Moldova, is going to be very long. What will happen next, though? What do these countries need to do now?
Well, the accession process, they usually divide the whole process into what they call chapters. So you've got negotiating chapters, you've over 30 of those, and they're kind of big discussion documents on different aspects of how a country is run. So, for example, the legal system or the plurality of the media or the judiciary, those kind of things. And you're going to have officials in Brussels working with officials in Ukraine to see how quickly Ukraine can come up to speed on those standards that the EU has on all those areas. Now, there's a specific problem, obviously, that this is a country at war. So, you know, how far is it that's going to slow down its ability to meet those standards. So that's going to be a major issue. But the European Commission President von der Leyen was there a couple of weeks ago, and she was sounded quite a positive note, saying she feels that Ukraine, the government there, had already been on the reform path. It's got the political willingness to do that, and that, you know, it can still continue on that path even as the war is going on.
We've been talking about all these complications, but if you think about the future and, say, Ukraine's membership of the European Union, how would the Union benefit from Ukraine?
Well, I think having a country like that that is bordering the EU as part of its own community, geopolitically would be quite important. We can see what's happened, for example, with gas. It's so still dependent on Russia, and you know, Ukraine is kind of in between Russia and Europe. So getting Ukraine into the sphere of influence, if you like, would be strategically very important. However, you know, as well as the issues that Ukraine itself brings, I mentioned the size, the poverty of the country. There's also kind of enlargement fatigue, which is set in here in Brussels. A lot of countries, they won't say it too loudly, but they feel disappointed that some countries who were admitted from former Soviet countries like Poland and Hungary got into the EU and then actually didn't keep up, you know, the standards that they were expected. For example, on rule of law, judiciary, media plurality. So as a result, I think a lot of people were put off the whole idea of enlargement here. However, the war, these big historical moments can change things. And here we are now, 4 months after the war, and now the Ukraine is on the path for EU membership. So look, I think it has kind of changed the calculation here.
Absolutely. Just finally, and quite in brief, if you may, Georgia was also applying for a candidate status. What was the message it got from Brussels?
Yeah, I think the message there, it was kind of lumped together with Moldova. And for a long time, they said that Georgia was just falling short, that there's too much there politically. The government there doesn't have the willingness to do the reforms necessary at the moment. There's been lots of protests there, for example. And, you know, it's just not at the right level. Moldova is different and has been moving closer towards the EU. It's got a very progressive president. Its foreign minister has been lobbying carefully. So they've decoupled the two, if you like. And that might be some kind of model we see at some point for Albania and North Macedonia that have been kind of coupled together, and they may serve to kind of decouple them.
Thanks for that update, Suzanne. That was Politico's Suzanne Lynch in Brussels. And now here is Monaco's Carlotta Rebello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. The US Senate has passed a gun control bill which has been described as the most significant firearms legislation in decades. The reforms include tougher background checks for buyers younger than 21 and $15 billion in funding for mental health programs and school security upgrades. Ukrainian forces in the city of Severodonetsk have been ordered to withdraw, according to the top regional official. Russian forces have nearly encircled the administrative center of the Luhansk region in recent days. Reportedly, the city's entire infrastructure has been completely destroyed. And the Monocle Minute reports on Indonesian President Joko Widodo's plans to travel to Kyiv and Moscow next week to meet his counterparts Volodymyr Zelensky and Vladimir Putin. For more, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Carlotta. Now, here in the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party has suffered a blow in the first by-elections since his recent no-confidence vote. The party lost seats in Tiverton and Honiton in Devon and Wakefield in Yorkshire. To look at the results and what they mean for the Conservative Party, I'm joined by Terry Stiassny, author and political journalist. Good afternoon to you.
Hi, Marcus.
Could you first put these by-election results in some kind of context? How bad are they exactly?
Well, they're extremely bad for the Conservative Party, and they're bad for two different sets of reasons, if you like. They were two very different constituencies at stake here. One of them was Wakefield in West Yorkshire, which had been a Labour-held seat, you know, for most of sort of certainly living memory, until the Conservatives won it at the last election in 2019. Now, the MP there had to step down because he was convicted of sexual offences, and the Labour managed to take the seat back with a majority of nearly 5,000 seats. So that's one of these so-called red wall seats, if you like, traditional Labour seats that the Conservatives had won. Now, Tiverton and Honiton in Devon is a very different place. It's a rural seat. It has almost always, again, you know, for certainly for the last 100 years, had a Conservative MP. It had a majority of 24,000 Conservative votes at the last election. Their MP had to resign because he was caught watching pornography in the House of Commons chamber. And there, the Liberal Democrats in this very rural constituency overturned this majority to end up with a majority of 6,000 votes over the Conservatives. And that was a 30% swing to the party against the Conservatives. So always round, this has been a bad set of results for the Conservative Party.
Looking at a number of possible reasons why voters would have abandoned the Conservatives, how much was all this about Boris Johnson?
Well, I mean, in part, yes, this certainly was about Boris Johnson. I mean, the winning Liberal Democrat in Tiverton and Honiton said that Boris Johnson came up on the every doorstep, that he had outstayed his welcome. I mean, that is, of course, what you would expect to hear from someone who'd been fighting a battle against the Conservatives. But also, you know, the bigger issues, the things like the economy have, of course, come into play. So Labour reacting to the Wakefield results said it showed that the country had lost confidence in the Conservatives, that Labour was back on the side of the working people. So that is what they are stressing. And of course, what is interesting now is how the Conservative Party are reacting to these results when, you know, it's only been a few weeks since Boris Johnson won a no-confidence vote called by his own backbench MPs.
Well, the party's co-chairman, Oliver Dowden, has already resigned, but Boris Johnson won't go, will he?
He won't go, you know, voluntarily or easily. I mean, Boris Johnson was apparently swimming in a Kigali hotel swimming pool in Rwanda this morning as the news of this resignation and these bad results came through. He was apparently blindsided, his sources say, by this result. But he's saying, you know, voters are going through a tough time. Midterm governments lose by-elections all the time. But this resignation of Oliver Dowden was really quite, you know, quite surprising. This happened at 5:25 in the morning when Oliver Dowden had been due to be the person to go on the radio and the TV and defend the government in the face of these by-election losses. And he said that, you know, he was shared the voters' feelings of being distressed and disappointed. And you can only ask, you know, well, who did you think that they were distressed and disappointed in? And who is Oliver Dowden disappointed in? And he, in his resignation letter, he kind of professed his loyalty to the Conservative Party rather than to the Prime Minister. So I think what we're waiting for now is to see whether anybody else follows him out of government. And we've already had a call from a former Conservative leader, Michael Howard, today, saying that the party and the country would be better off under new leadership.
What do you expect from the Conservative Party now? What is going to happen next?
Well, this is the difficult question, really. So we've had some, you know, professions of loyalty today. So the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, who's often suggested that he might be someone to resign, that this might then precipitate, you know, a crisis, an ultimate crisis for Boris Johnson. But he was saying, you know, look, we all take responsibility for the by-election results, and he was determined to continue tackling the cost of living. You know, it seems like lots of people are kind of throwing little snowballs and little stones down the slope, and they're kind of hoping that an avalanche is going to happen, which is going to be the only thing that ultimately pushes Boris Johnson out. But you very much get the sense that we're not quite there yet, though it might happen, and that Boris Johnson certainly doesn't want to go.
How big of a problem is Boris Johnson for the party at the moment?
I think he is a problem, certainly, you know, if his own backbench MPs, let's not forget that although he survived the confidence vote, 148 of his own Conservative MPs said they didn't want him to carry on as leader. So there's a lot of issues here that are causing him trouble, and some of the policies he's coming up as responses with, for instance, you know, the sending of asylum seekers to Rwanda, which has hit all sorts of legal obstacles. The trouble is that once it comes down to, you know, the character of the Prime Minister and people finding that a problem, and his behaviour and what he has done, that's something that's very difficult to change. You know, Prime Ministers can promise to change their style, change the people around them, so forth. But if people ultimately think that your character is at stake, that's something that is fundamentally difficult to change.
Terry Stiassny, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. It is 2016 in Seoul, 1416 in Helsinki, and 7:16 a.m. in Washington, D.C. In Myanmar, the country's deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi has been moved from house arrest to a prison cell in the capital. The latest move by the country's ruling junta means she is unlikely to ever be released from detention. For more, I'm joined by Ronan Lee, author of Myanmar's Rohingya Genocide, Identity, History and Hate Speech. Welcome to the programme, Ronan. Could you first recap some of these over 20 offences she was charged with?
Well, she's been charged with ridiculous offences, such as illegally importing walkie-talkies that were supposedly provided to her security team by the military themselves. She's also been charged with a series of corruption offences. And she's somebody that, while you might criticise some elements of her political leadership, she's generally not regarded as a corrupt figure at all. And it illustrates, I think, the absurd nature of the politically motivated charges against her. This is about the Myanmar military seeking to portray Aung San Suu Kyi as an illegitimate leader of the country because she's a common criminal in their view. And that's, I think, why we've now seen the announcement that she'll be moved from the undisclosed location, possibly house arrest that she was in previously, into solitary confinement within a newly built prison compound in the capital, Naypyidaw, where she will likely wear a prison uniform. And I think it won't be very long before the military leadership of Myanmar releases photographs of Aung San Suu Kyi wearing that prison uniform, because that's their narrative, that she's a common criminal and not a legitimate political leader.
How much influence and support will she still have after this?
Well, huge influence and support among the people of Myanmar. I mean, she's still revered by ordinary people within Myanmar. I mean, her father, General Aung San, in fact, founded the Myanmar military. He's the independence hero of the country. She's then regarded as a secular saint, a figure who stood up to the previous brutal military dictatorship in Myanmar and sided with the people against the military that her father had founded. So she's seen as a figure that ordinary people revere. And she's still the figure that the National Unity Government, this is the alternative government of the country, it's the politicians who were elected in 2020, the deposed MPs and others, it's still the person that they regard as the legitimate head of government of Myanmar. She's all over their website, and she's the person that they will turn to if they can get the military out of power. But the military is very keen to portray her as a criminal and to suggest that she'll never again be able to play a role in the political leadership of Myanmar. I mean, she's facing 190 years in jail. She's 77. She turned 77 on the weekend. So that's a very clear message from the military junta that they don't expect her back. And they're telling the people of Myanmar that they shouldn't expect Aung San Suu Kyi to lead them in the future.
Tell me about your thoughts about the situation in the country. What does the future, for example, look like for the opposition in the country?
Well, the future for Myanmar is ongoing conflict. The people do not want military rule. They've made that abundantly clear. There's nationwide civil disobedience movement. The National Unity Government has encouraged a defensive war, they're calling it, against military rule. So there's people's defense organizations, militia groups springing up all over the country. They're taking on the military. They're fighting with the military. And they're joining up with ethnic armed groups associated with ethnic minorities to take on the military. So, it's a civil war. I mean, there's no question about that. It's a state of conflict within the country. Half a million people have been displaced since the coup of last year. The UN says that 13 million people face food insecurity. I mean, that's a euphemism for 13 million people are about to be starving in Myanmar. The situation, I think, is catastrophic for ordinary people. But the issue here is that they're prepared to deal with that because they do not want the military to rule them. They had 5 decades of military rule from the 1960s. They know what it's like, and they don't want it again.
Ronan, the military junta is obviously opposed to Aung San Suu Kyi, and actually it seems to be having problems with your book as well, Myanmar's Rohingya Genocide, Identity History and Hate Speech. A publishing house in Myanmar that was distributing your book has been shut down. Tell us more about that.
Well, the Myanmar military is desperately worried about accounts of the atrocities that they committed against the Rohingya in 2017 being made available to ordinary people in Myanmar. This is part of the tactics of genocide against the Rohingya, that that the military denies the violence that they forced Rohingya civilians to suffer. They also, I think, want ordinary people in Myanmar not to join the dots and realise that similar style of violence, scorched earth tactics against civilians, is now being brought by the country's military to the Buddhist heartland. They're using the same sorts of scorched earth tactics that the Rohingya would be very familiar with, and they're using it against Buddhist communities in central Myanmar. And that's, I think, what prompted the junta to make an announcement in state media that the book was banned and that the publisher's license was revoked. I mean, this is a military that's concerned about its legitimacy. It's keen to hide its crimes. I mean, it's pretty common to genocidal regimes the world over, that they try to hide the crimes that they've committed. In this case, by advertising this in state media, they're making very clear to ordinary people in Myanmar that they should self-censor any discussion about genocide and about military atrocities against minorities. And it's part of an attempt by the military leadership to silence freedom of expression and to cover up the crimes that they've committed.
Ronan, what is your own reaction? What does it feel like to have your book banned?
Look. I mean, in one sense, it's an endorsement that it's valuable academic work and that it provides a platform to hear the stories of people who were very badly mistreated. On the other hand, no author wants to see their book banned. They want their material to be read, and the Rohingya who told me their stories and their accounts of what happened to them. They want the world to know. They don't want to see this book banned, and they want people in Myanmar to know. I mean, that was very, came very clearly in the research. They want people in Myanmar, their ancestral, this is their home. Myanmar is their home. It's their ancestral lands, and they want people there to know what happened to them. So it's not a great, I mean, I don't feel that's a good outcome at all to have the book banned by state media. But in a sense, it is an endorsement that it contains important work and it's work that I'll continue to publish.
Important work indeed. Ronan Lee, thank you so much for joining us here on Monocle 24. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Let's continue with the latest business news with Bloomberg's Euan Potts. Euan, you have bad news for us, more news of travel disruption in Europe this summer.
Hello, Marcus. Germany's Lufthansa is cancelling more than 3,000 flights after a wave of coronavirus infections worsened an already bad staffing problem. Now, Germany's flagship airline says it's going to scrap the domestic and European routes in July and August. It really adds to the travelling chaos mounting in Europe as the crucial summer vacation season gets on the way. It's crucial for airlines, it's crucial for a lot of tourist destinations, and it's crucial for people, many of whom have not had a holiday in the last couple of years. Travel demand has really been rebounding dramatically around the world with the lifting of the virus curbs, leaving a lot of airlines really struggling to cope and subjecting passengers to long queues and cancellations. Adding to the trouble, growing labour unrest as workers seek pay increases to keep up with the soaring cost of living. Ryanair, Europe's biggest discount airline, workers there are staging walkouts in countries including Italy, France and Portugal. British Airways check-in staff are set to strike at London's Heathrow Airport. And in Spain, EasyJet crews there are planning 9 days of strike action in July. So it is really a worsening picture for European airline travel over the course of the summer. Chatting to my colleague a little bit earlier about her summer holiday plans, she says she's going to take the train somewhere.
Oh no. Let's continue with more news from Europe. Natural gas prices.
Yeah, Germany's economy minister says that he can't be sure that Russia will resume shipments through a key gas pipeline. That raises the prospect of a fresh surge in prices in Europe's biggest economy and perhaps rationing this winter. And a warning from Klaus Müller, he's head of the German Federal Network Agency. He says that prices for consumers could triple in Germany, and he's urging households and businesses to put money aside and to save energy wherever possible. He says that we have a very, very cold winter. If we're careless and far too generous with gas, then it won't be pretty. Germany, you remember yesterday, raised its gas risk level to the second highest alarm phase. That's just one step below the third and final emergency stage, which would involve state control over distribution. The standoff with Russia has been escalating after Gazprom slashed shipments through the Nord Stream pipeline. This is the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, leaving it at just 40% of capacity and putting Germany's reserves for the winter at risk. Of course, this is the period of the year when the countries traditionally build up their gas reserves ready for the winter, but that gas is not flowing through the Nord Stream pipeline, which is a big problem for Germany, which is so dependent, of course, on Russian gas. Across Europe, benchmark gas price futures a little bit lower today, but still up 12% over the course of this week.
Thanks for this update. That was Bloomberg's Euan Potts. Have a good weekend. It's 12:28 here in London. You are with The Briefing. And finally, in today's programme, let's hear from Andrew Miller as he tells us what we know now that we didn't 7 days ago.
We learned this week that looking at stripy items turns children gay. It was news to us as well. We learned this from the Ministry of Commerce of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, whose word for this sort of thing obviously has to be taken extremely seriously. We learned that the ministry's diligent invigilators have been staging raids on shops in Riyadh and seizing children's clothes and toys deemed to be worrisomely rainbow patterned. And we learned that the ministry had kindly obviated our need to stress that we are not making any of this up by filming and
and broadcasting actual grown men, salaried employees of the state, fossicking through rails and shelves of brightly coloured kid stuff in search of degenerate merchandise to confiscate and adding their own suitably dramatic music.
جولة تفتيشية حصلنا عدد من المخالفات في الأداب العامة اللي هي مثل منتجات زي هذه بشكل صريح بشكل الداخلي أيضا هذه نشوفها إيحاء من الشكل الخارجي.
While this may all appear to the untrained observer like an absolutely abject waste of everybody's time, we learned that this was far from the case. The ministry explained itself with a statement, which will now be read with solemnity befitting the seriousness of the menace they are seeking to thwart by Monocle 24's completely sane and normal occurrences desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Our supervisory teams carry out rounds of sales outlets, seize and confiscate products that contains symbols and indications that call for anomalies and contradict normal common sense.
And who can argue with that? We would mildly note that we have also learned that the shirt Saudi Arabia's football team proposes to wear at this November's World Cup has a green stripe around the collar. And that there is, and we checked, a green stripe in rainbows, which means that there is surely a thin end of the wedge concern here, Saudi Arabia's footballers being only the width of six more coloured bands from scarcely imaginable depravity. This is something the ministry's inspectors should probably look into once they have completed the vital task with which they are presently occupied. We learned anyway that it had been quite the week for banning stuff, as we learned that listeners to Ukrainian radio stations would henceforth have to struggle along without hearing much of this sort of thing. Raspberry Lada there by the Gayazov brothers, a Moscow duo whose name may also preclude them from much of a career in Saudi Arabia. You see how cleverly and subtly stitched together these monologues are. You see. We learned that the Gayazovs and all other modern Russian artists are to be henceforth banished from Ukraine's airwaves. Can we get a sort of shepherd's crook whisking off stage kind of noise behind banished? Righto, let's try this. Banished from Ukraine's airwaves. There it is. After Ukraine's parliament, which, with all due respect to their nation's present struggles, one might have imagined having more urgent matters to which they could be usefully attending, passed a new law to that effect. So, just to make our position clear, while we're not necessarily against threatening some sort of prosecution to prevent people listening to or indeed making this sort of racket, whether it comes from Russia or anywhere else, really, we learned, much to our bewilderment, that wielding any legal sanction whatsoever is actually necessary. Anyway, sticking with the theme of people making strange choices, we learned that, if polls are any guide, the voters of the American state of Missouri are reasonably likely to send this thundering jackass to the U.S. Senate.
I'm Eric Greitens, Navy SEAL, and today we're going rhino hunting. The rhino feeds on corruption and is marked by the stripes of cowardice.
To lend context to the extremely clever joke underpinning this campaign ad, RINO is an acronym denoting Republican in name only. And because it is also a homophone, that's a linguistic term, not something Saudi Arabia's Ministry of Commerce needs to worry about. Again, these monologues aren't just slung together. A homophone for rhino, as in abbreviation of rhinoceros, Eric Greiton, for it is he, has brilliantly and wittily conflated the two, proceeding on the doubtless correct assumption that shooting both kinds of rhinos is the sort of thing of which his voters would approve. Do you see what he has done here? Honestly, he must have had his best people up all night on this one. Rhino, as in Republican in name only, is a term of abuse frequently flung by seething Trumpists in the direction of those of their fellow Conservatives who also maintain a passing interest in the Constitution, the rule of law, norms and conventions, that kind of stuff. Greitens, previously actually governor of Missouri, which we suppose somebody has to be, appears in his ad/thinly-veiled death threat carrying a shotgun and surrounded by cosplaying ninnies in khaki camouflage.
Join the MAGA crew. Get a rhino hunting permit. There's no bagging limit, no tagging limit, and it doesn't expire until we save our country.
Intrigued enough to have a bit of a flip through the governor's CV, we learned, though would characterize our surprise as short of complete, that subheadings on his Wikipedia page include, but are by no means limited to, indictment, impeachment and resignation, campaign finance violations, and affair and sexual assault allegations. It's always the ones you least suspect. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Mullett.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Charlie Field McCourt. Our researcher was Isabel Rosen and our studio manager was Callum McLean. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.